Peter R. Bregan, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT, and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour.
This is Peter Bregan, and I'm as always glad to be talking to the best audience in the world when it comes to psychology, psychiatry, mental health, and all the broad fields that surround it, and advocacy in the field as well. I'm going to leap right into my introduction today because I've been waiting a long time to be able to talk to John Reed on my radio show. John is a very interesting and very creative human being. He's in Great Britain, one more good, solid person in Great Britain. He's at the University of East London. I became especially aware of his work in 2010 when he published an article with Richard Bentall on electroshock treatment. It was and is an amazing piece of work in which he examined all the placebo-controlled studies of ECT. And this is what he wrote. The authors wrote, excuse me, and I want to read it to you because it's rare in the literature to find people, and especially people with strong academic backgrounds and connections, who simply write straightforward truth. John Reed and his colleague wrote, "Given the strong evidence of persistent and for some permanent brain damage, brain dysfunction, primarily evidenced in the form of retrograde and anterograde amnesia, and the evidence of a slight but significant increase in the risk of death, the cost-benefit analysis for ECT is so poor that its use cannot be scientifically justified." John is, I think, originally from New Zealand. He has done a lot of work and is doing a lot of work in the area of psychosis, which I hope we'll get into today. He is the editor of a journal called Psychosis. He's on the executive board of the International Society for the Psychological Treatments of Schizophrenia. He's the author of a book, the editor of a book, Models of Madness: Psychological, Social, and Biological Approaches to Schizophrenia. This is a man who's both a researcher and an advocate. He's a reformer, and he is also working within the academic community. This is an amazing combination. John Reed, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Peter. It's lovely to be on your show, and I just want to start very quickly by acknowledging and thanking you for the decades of work you've done exposing the damage done by psychiatric treatments and the bad science behind it. So I just waited a long time to say that to you. So thank you very much indeed. It's lovely to be with you.
Thank you, John. Thank you very, very much. We could begin anywhere. I'm very interested in the work you're doing in the field of psychosis and treatment and understanding it, and I'm interested in your work in ECT, and there's probably other things I don't know that I'd be very interested in. Where would you like to begin? You could begin with how you got into being a critic.
Yeah, okay. I think it probably all started in my very first job when I was a nursing attendant in New York, of all places. And I was just a curious young man asking the psychiatrist there how they understood things like hearing voices, and which always sort of made perfect sense to me. If you listen to the people and ask them what the voices are about, they'll tell you, and it all made sense. But the psychiatrists seemed to have a different view, and I asked them to explain it to me, and they said that the voices were caused by this thing called schizophrenia, and I asked them how they knew that, and they said, well, that's the sort of thing that people with schizophrenia do. And that seemed to me sort of five-year-old backward circular logic, which didn't really explain anything, but they were very convinced that there was this thing called schizophrenia which causes things. And over the years, as I studied that more and more, it's very clear that there is no such thing as schizophrenia scientifically. There's no reliability to that construct. And it explains, sorry about the beeping there, and it explains absolutely nothing. But we have a mental health system around the world that is based on this very crude idea that there are things called mental illnesses that cause people to have different experiences. And then the assumption, of course, is that these are biological-type illnesses and therefore require biological treatments. So anyway, that's how it all started for me, the difference between the psychiatrist's understanding of what was going on and what happened when I actually just sat down and talked with these people, who most of the time, when they were in better shape, not all the time, because obviously some of the time they were very distressed and confused and angry and scared, but when they were a bit calmer, they would explain to me that certain things had happened in their life, usually not very nice things. And that's why they had ended up in a mess, and they needed some help with that. They needed somebody to talk to about what had happened to them, and really didn't appreciate being told they had something wrong with their brains or their genes and being drugged up to the eyeballs and so forth. And that was 40 years ago, Peter. So here I am now still laboring away trying to support people around the world who are, like yourself and many, many others, who are taking a stance against this dehumanizing and quite debilitating approach to human distress.
John, that's about as nice a summary as I've ever heard. And it's you know, it's kind of similar. It's actually very similar to my own experience, which was 1954, walking into a state mental hospital as a volunteer in my first year at Harvard. And the patients running up to me and screaming, "I don't belong here, I don't belong here," and giving me little messages to carry to relatives they probably hadn't seen in decades. And it just struck me, I didn't belong in there, they didn't belong in there. And that was the beginning of my trying to listen to what people were saying. I was 18 years old at the time.
Yeah.
And so did you say you were in nursing at the time, or did I mishear you?
No, I was just a nursing attendant.
And
interestingly, of course, the lower that you are on the hierarchy, the more people are likely to talk to you. They tend to learn quite quickly not to tell the psychiatrist what's going on, because if they talk about their voices, the drugs get increased. If they talk about being upset about anything, the drugs get increased. So they tend to learn not to talk to the psychiatrist, but to talk. It's safer to talk to a lowly nursing aide. So I was lucky that way. They didn't find me too threatening.
Yeah, that's how it was with me as a volunteer. But I've never told this story on the air, I don't think, or publicly. But when I was in my first year of psychiatric training at Harvard, by then I'd had 4 years of walking around by myself in state mental hospitals through my college career. And so when I would be on call at night, John, I would just sit down in the middle room, which psychiatrists never did, you know, in the day room or whatever you'd call it, be early evening. Yeah. And all the patients would come out of their rooms and sit around and we'd talk. Now, I don't mean group therapy. We just sit around and talk. And I got accused of manipulating the patients to like me.
God forbid they would like any of it.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
How threatening is that? Yeah.
So where were you in New York? You were in New York City?
Yeah, I was in the Bronx at Montefiore Hospital, which actually was a relatively, I didn't realize at the time, but relatively progressive. So this was in the 1970s, and they weren't medicating anybody for the first 48 hours. And they found then, unsurprisingly, that about half of people ended up not needing medication. Now, that was quite a short-lived experiment, because that's nowadays considered almost unethical not to medicate everybody with a diagnosis of schizophrenia. It's considered somewhat negligent if you don't do that, which shows right there and then, it shows exactly, shows beyond a shadow of a doubt that psychiatry is not an evidence-based profession, because there is no study showing that antipsychotic medication reduces the chances of anybody killing themselves or killing anybody else, which is usually the reason for rushing in with these drugs. There is evidence that they help about 20%. You know all this stuff, Peter, so I'm not really telling you that so much as sharing it with whoever doesn't know. They help, compared to placebo, they help about 20%, and the other 80% of people, it's no different. Their response is no different from placebo. And, of course, the problem, as you've written about as much as anybody in the world, is that these drugs have very major adverse effects, including, of course, shortening of lifespan. And there is no other branch of medicine that is permitted to use chemicals that are so dangerous and so damaging.
My wife is encouraging me to talk about it as genocide of the people labeled mentally ill, now that we have these high death rates from a number of classes of our drugs, not just from the antipsychotics. And I might even question this 20% improvement. I think that if we look into what the improvement is, it's going to be a lobotomy effect. It's going to be that the...
Well, it's 20% in a very simplistic approach to definition of outcome. As you know, it's a symptom reduction, which has very little to do with quality of life. What the research does say is that overall, one in five people do slightly better than placebo in reducing, you know, a score on a symptom scale measuring hallucinations and delusions. That, however, as I say, has nothing to do with whether the person feels better or is more able to function in the world, has more friends, has a job, or anything like that, the things that people actually care about, which is a whole different kettle of fish. But people don't, psychiatrists, they do, I know it sounds condescending to say it, but they do mean well, but they don't, from that narrow medical perspective, they can only think in terms of symptoms, and they tend to miss what's important to each individual person, which of course is different from one person to the next. The most important person thing for one person might be that they haven't got a girlfriend or boyfriend. Another one might be that they haven't got somewhere to live, et cetera, et cetera. But all the psychiatrists see is I must reduce the frequency of the hallucinations, which for some people, of course, in some situations, is the one thing that's keeping them going. Sometimes the voices are positive, supportive, nurturing voices, more often a mixture of bad and good. But I guess I'm trying to get across it's the complexity of the individual person, that this crude and unscientific ideology that pervades psychiatry, it can't deal with the complexity of the individual person that is sitting in front of the psychiatrist. It's just not an adequate model to deal with human beings.
I really like the way you talk about this stuff because it's very, very connected to people and actual people. One of the points I would make, and I'm really enjoying this conversation, by the way. You've leaped right in, and we're having I really like this back and forth about it. Mm-hmm. I think that if these studies that counted the symptom reduction also counted reduction in general engagement and interest in life, if they ask them, how many times did you think about your wife or your husband or your children today? I think that number would go down. Even how interested are you in the football game on TV with your favorite team playing, that it would all go down because it's not in any way specific for symptoms. And that's just Jerry Klarman and other psychiatrists in the U.S. certainly just built a lie about symptom reduction being something specific. It's part of the generalized, what I call deactivation of the person or the lobotomy effect person. And I really like your point.
It's still an accident that when they first came out in the 1950s, they were called major tranquilizers, weren't they? I think that's an accurate description of what they actually are. They're not treating any specific imbalances or claimed imbalances or any specific symptoms. They're basically tranquilizing people.
Well, you're still using euphemisms.
I'm honest about that. I can see certain situations in which I or a loved one might benefit from being calmed down artificially for a few days if we were, too out of it.
These are the last drugs you choose for that, though, if you wanted to, wouldn't it? I mean, I'd I'd rather have a sedative or a drink, rather than, due to my nervous system, what these drugs do.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's just from a scientific point of view, it's bizarre that they, even if you believed in a biological model, they have not been able to come up with more sophisticated medications. It's almost like in this field, it doesn't really matter that much. We'll just tranquilize people, and that's all it really, really takes. But I think the other thing that's going on here, to be honest, is that a lot of the folks that end up as psychiatrists are emotionally unable to deal with what's in front of them. It's too scary for them when people get really distressed or talk about things that the psychiatrist can't understand or is outside of their own personal experience. And I think the drugs are often medicating the psychiatrist's anxiety. And I think people who aren't able to sit with someone while they're in acute distress and just be there without having to try and suppress the person's experience really ought to go get another job. They ought to get out of the profession and acknowledge to themselves, this is not for me, because you need to be able to sit with people in distress without artificially tranquilizing them. And I think it's an emotional need that some of these folk are just not up to it emotionally.
Yes. I'm old enough to have seen a somewhat of a change in who goes into psychiatry.
Oh, yeah.
I think that in the days when there was still a psychoanalytic movement and a psychotherapy movement that was a small portion of psychiatry, a lot of the people who initially went in were people who went to medical school, had some personal problems, got some therapy, got some help, and now they were in medical school or in their some medical residency, and then they would go into psychiatry because they'd gotten some help. I don't think that's the way it is anymore. I think now what you get is a much more kind of withdrawn person who looks at people in this horribly objectified way because they don't engage well, and who kind of is often those folks do. They have a kind of a manipulative model of the universe, which fits with psychiatry. So I think now you're getting people into the profession who literally can't relate. Even if they wanted to, they're limited in their social capacities. They're the exact opposite of the kinds of folks that you would want to be there. And of course, then it fits perfectly with their being told you can't talk to schizophrenia, which is this horrible phrase you hear. I don't know if you've been in the business long enough to see a change in that regard, but I do think it's attracting different kind of people in the last few decades.
I think that's right. I haven't looked at the data recently in England, but a while ago when we looked at it, we saw that the people going into psychiatry were the people who came bottom of their medical school in their final exams, who they really wanted to be surgeons or GPs, but they weren't bright enough to do that.
Oh,
so they ended up having to do psychiatry even though they didn't want to do it. And then you've got this awful situation where you've got these folks, some of whom are not particularly bright, who have this extra pressure to try and prove to the world that they're a real doctor, which is what they wanted to be, but they couldn't get into it. So they sort of act more and more like a medical person than medical people themselves. And not all of them, of course. That's unfair. There are some excellent people within psychiatry who do go in for the right reasons and do manage to connect. But the profession as a whole is a very sad state of affairs, scientifically, ethically, and humanistically. I would be embarrassed to be a psychiatrist, and I know it must have been a struggle for you, Peter, over the years, because I know that psychiatry. Yeah, they can be pretty mean to mere psychologists like me, but they reserve their worst venom for their own, in my experience. I've had several friends who are psychiatrists who've been professionally destroyed for just taking a non-biological stand. I think it sort of operates somewhat like a cult, in my experience.
Yes, very much. In regard to what I've done, of course, taking them on head on, I mean, just imagine your worst whistleblower movie, and literally, yeah. I pretty much experienced every bit of what they can do. I feel very blessed to be alive, actually, to have survived those early years, and I think that the fact that I did survive and fought off a variety of horrendous attacks maybe opened the way for some other people, to join in, because we do have so many more people now talking about these issues.
Indeed. Yeah.
Not so many in psychiatry. I think the good people talking about it in psychiatry are mostly in Great Britain.
There's a strong critical psychiatry movement in Great Britain. I think that's true. I think it would be harder in America.
Oh,
which I think is probably the most biological mental health system in the world, although Australia is trying hard to catch up. I just spent a couple of years in Australia, and it's abysmal. We've got ECT rates going off the scale, and just a psychological model is just really unheard of there.
Yeah, I think the grip of the psychopharmaceutical, just the whole pharmaceutical industry in the U.S. is greater than anywhere in the world, and we're their primary market. It's the first place the marketing really hits with all its might, I think, is in the U.S. to establish the precedence. Like a tsunami, you know, the earthquake is here, and the tsunami spreads around the world in regard to psychiatric drugs. It's quite a disastrous situation. Tell me something, and tell the audience something more about what's going on in the field of research in psychosis. You're the editor of a journal, and you're on the executive board of the International Society for Psychological Treatments of Schizophrenia. I've never had much to do with that organization. I think years and years ago, maybe in the 70s, they invited me to speak, and never again. So I'm not sure what happens there. Tell me about what you're doing. And
well, in the research side of things, there's been quite a shift in the last 15 years, to the extent that the research community, at least, has broadly accepted that psychosis is a trauma-based phenomenon, that things like child abuse, physical and sexual, and child neglect, and war trauma, and all those sorts of things are clearly predictive of psychosis. We've done some of that research ourselves in New Zealand, but others around the world have done that also. A lot of it's come from the Netherlands, Jim Van Os's group. But I mean, it's not anything new. It's not anything that the public didn't know, for instance. One of my other areas of research is surveying the causal beliefs of the public. And in every country except your own, Peter, which will come as no surprise to you, in 23 countries, the public, when asked what causes psychosis or madness or schizophrenia, they all say bad things happening. They all say poverty, loneliness, abuse, violence, war. It's only America where they think it's a biological model. Interestingly, that doesn't mean psychiatry is influenced around the world, but the public have always known that bad things happen and they screw you up. That's such an obvious... you don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that. But
John, I didn't know that research. That is really interesting to me, that the U.S. is the only country where common sense has been wiped out by all the propaganda.
Yep.
I mean, that's...
Yep. It is interesting, isn't it?
Very.
And it's for the rest of us, of course, it's
embarrassing.
A little embarrassing. Sorry about that. But it is encouraging that in the rest of the world, where there is slightly less propaganda from the drug companies, at least there's no direct-to-consumer advertising anywhere other than America. And interestingly, New Zealand is the other country where that's legal. So countries other than that, and even in New Zealand, the public does understand that the cause of madness is bad things happening. So, in the research world, we've done a lot of research showing that child abuse and so forth is highly predictive, which, of course, was somewhat controversial at first, and we were attacked for family blaming and so forth.
I have a book on my shelves. I don't know. I think it's from the 70s that's called Stress and Psychosis. I mean, it was an idea that was once broadly accepted. At least you could get a book published on it decades ago. Is there a really good book on this? Is your book in 2004? Is that state of the art? What do you recommend to folks who want to hear more about psychosis and trauma and stress?
Well, I think Models of Madness tries to cover, which is a book we've edited, there's 23 of us contributing. It covers most of the issues, covers the trauma and other causes, poverty and so forth. It also covers the treatments, critiques, antipsychotics and ECT. But then there's a whole section at the end about what actually does work, what the research says does work, which unsurprisingly is mostly psychological and social treatments and support groups like hearing voices groups and so forth. But there's several books out on psychosis and trauma, specifically Colin Ross, who you all know of, American colleague of yours, has written extensively on psychosis and trauma. And other people in Britain, Tony Morrison, Richard Benkel, quite a few people. So it's not quite so controversial anymore. The difficulty, of course, is getting that translated into actual services.
Well, and getting it read in the U.S., too, is a problem.
Yeah. And we know that people are still not being asked very often about what happened in their childhoods. And I spent years training mental health professionals in New Zealand how to do that. And when people outside of mental health, when I told them that I spent quite a lot of my time training mental health staff, how to ask people what's gone on in their lives, they would wet themselves laughing. Like, how can it be that mental health professionals need training in how to do that? Because
they need de-indoctrination.
That's what we do.
That's what it is. What do you think right now are the best programs around for helping people?
Well, there's two approaches which are actually quite contrasting. The first is there is a lot of very good research showing that CBT for psychosis, specifically designed for psychosis and not designed to reduce symptoms, but designed to reduce the stress associated with the symptoms and to improve quality of life. There's a lot of research showing that that is effective. And then the other is the Hearing Voices Network, which is now alive and flourishing, and I think it's 22 countries, including in the United States. I know that Jackie Dillon, for instance, is actually in the States right now doing training. She's the chair of our English Hearing Voices Network. And these are folk who 20 or 30 years ago would be the sort of folk that would be involved in the sort of anti-psychiatry survivors movement, of attacking psychiatry, and they've kind of got fed up with that, although they still do that, of course, but they've got tired of trying to change psychiatry and wait for psychiatry to be useful and effective, and they've just got on with it themselves. Started forming support groups around the world where their people can come together, talk about the experience of hearing voices without being labeled, without being drugged, without being judged, and where they can support one another and give people practical advice about, well, this worked for me, that didn't work for me. And it's an entirely different approach. And it's, I think it's the most exciting thing that's happened certainly in the field of psychosis for 20 years. The fear, of course, is that will, as it's beginning to happen in England, that will get subsumed into mainstream services who will take it on and change it somewhat and turn it into something else. But at least that, whatever it turns into, will be better than treatment as usual. And then I suppose the third area, it's not specifically about psychosis,
John,
but the open dialogue
approach. That's just what happened in the U.S. with Alcoholics Anonymous. They'd start meeting after the hospital started having their meetings in a medical setting, and then they all started thinking drugs were a good idea along with AA.
It's a potential
disaster, but I interrupted you, and you're saying so many interesting things.
I was just going to say there's a third exciting development, which is the Finnish model, the open dialogue, which is basically about getting everybody together right from the beginning of a breakdown or whatever you want to call it, friends, family, and treating it as more of a group phenomenon and, rather than the problem with an individual. And some of the principles of that movement are similar to Lauren Mosher's Soteria House, where it's important not to diagnose and judge and label and just essentially listen, which you wouldn't think you would have to teach mental health professionals, but apparently you kind of do.
I'd love to. It sounds like Jackie Dillon would be a good person to have on the show. I haven't had somebody from the Voice Hearers movement on in a little while. I've had a couple of people on, but I don't think in a year or so. Maybe you could email me her contact if you have that.
I certainly will put you in touch with Jackie. She's quite an amazing person. And that's one of the wonderful things about this movement of ours. You do meet the best people as you travel around the world. People have been through awful things in their lives and somehow come through it and are now advocating for changes and providing services themselves in different ways. So it's a hard struggle. And as you know, it can be very frustrating at times because it doesn't seem like things are changing. But at least outside the system, things really are changing, and people have just got fed up of waiting and just getting on with it, which is I think is very exciting.
I think it's the only solution. Getting psychiatry to change is so little in its own self-interest, as
indeed,
it perceives its self-interest, that, and it's always proven pretty much impossible to get people to give up power, whether it's the power of an authoritarian religion that's working with the state, or whether it's slavery working with the state, or whether it's psychiatry working with the state. It's pretty impossible without force and massive change and sometimes, you know, warfare to get these large systems to change. I think that what has to happen with psychiatry is people just stop going, and that they do develop and turn to other alternatives. And there's a lot of just plain old good therapists out there that help people all the time. So it's
indeed,
not like if people stopped going to psychiatrists, they would be bereft of any help. There's a lot of pretty good therapy going on. So I don't see psychiatry. Do you see any hope of psychiatry changing, or is that too much to talk about on the air?
I don't, Peter, because the first thing they'd have to do two things to change. First of all, they'd have to put up a proper professional ethical boundary between themselves and the drug companies. And they don't seem capable of that. Sometimes they play around the edges of that a little bit. They introduce a few rules and regulations about, you know, you can't go to Hawaii for 2 weeks and live off the fat of the drug companies. But they still basically are totally in hock to the drug companies. Till that changes, there's no hope. And the other thing is that they would have to give up their right to compulsorily treat people. And that isn't going to happen, I don't think, unless there's enough legal cases around the world that I think that's the only way we can take them on, because we can't defeat them in terms of evidence base, because they're just not interested in the research. So it has to be in courts of law, I think, all around the world. And there are some examples of that, but not enough. As I've got older, I think that I do think the only way to stop them is through the courts. But even that's difficult. We had this bizarre case in Australia that was widely publicized internationally that I was involved with just before I left Melbourne, where they had given over 80 consecutive ECTs to this man in Melbourne and had him tied to his bed at one point for over 30 days consecutively. And we being a number of psychiatrists and myself and lawyers, did everything we could to stop this bizarre cruelty, is what it was. It went as far as the United Nations Human Rights Committee, who wrote to the state of Victoria in Australia instructing them to cease and desist. And the state of Victoria basically told them to piss off, to be honest, excuse my language. It just seems that this group of people, once you've got this sort of label, have no rights whatsoever, and psychiatry operates beyond the law in some instances. So how do you stop that? They seem shameless. They weren't embarrassed, these psychiatrists. One of them went on, the head psychiatrist in this case went on television and said, "We don't understand what all the fuss is about. He's not chained to his bed. We use Velcro." And he thought people were going to go, "Oh, okay then."
Oh, Lord.
It's quite frightening. That's an extreme case, to be honest, but it's because it's extreme that I cite it, that with psychiatrists giving second and third opinions and me writing my little brains off in the media and on social media, we couldn't, we just could not stop them. It was worrying. But perhaps you shouldn't draw too much from one case, and it was rather an extreme case.
Well, no, I think the courts...
Can I see psychiatry reforming itself? Absolutely not. So it's going to have to be people going round them or standing up to them. I think other professionals sometimes need to have a bit more of a backbone and speak back to psychiatry. They are actually a tiny minority of the mental health workforce. But we have nurses and psychologists and others sort of kowtowing to them far more than they ought to, I think.
Oh, God, everything you're talking about is true. The courts have their limits. I've run into horrendous problems in the courts. I do a huge amount of legal work. And I do product liability against the drug companies. I do criminal cases where people have been driven out of their minds and commit crimes on psych drugs, and do malpractice. And once you start to get momentum in a particular area, they try to cave the world in on you. And and judges are just people, and people can be gotten to. And again, I think the state has a lot to do with that. I was just out of the blue thinking about the Dred Scott decision in the U.S. before the Civil War, where the Supreme Court decided that you weren't free even if you got out of the South and got to Boston. Yeah. They could still catch you and bring you back. And almost anybody could do it. So the problem is how inseparable psychiatry is from the state and state functions.
I think that's important, because if we don't remember that, Peter, we can end up sort of blaming individual psychiatrists as bad people. And some of them do bad things, there's no doubt about it, but it's the function they serve for all of us, really. I mean, the function is that it's a social control function, as we know. But they are mandated by all of us. We give them the power to deal with people who are very different, who are a bit scary, and who are potentially dangerous but haven't broken the law. And that's, you know, not a big group of people, but it's to some of us, some people, that's a scary group of people. And psychiatry has been given this job of dealing with that. And is that their fault? I don't know, but we have to acknowledge that is the function. They wrap it up as helping people, but the function really is to control people who are frightening because they're different or because they might do something dangerous. And they fulfill that role for society. And that's the scary part. If we must acknowledge that, we don't really understand what's going on. The second part of the function, of course, is their role in denying things like child abuse, the effects of inequality, effects of all of the bad things in society that politicians don't want to deal with. So when people crack under the pressure of living in this sort of system we've got, they're there to blame the person's brain or their genes rather than the social inequality. And I don't think it's an accident that the country with the largest inequality between the top 10% and bottom 10% in the world has the most biological approach to understanding human distress.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important concept that I have not much talked about here on the show. I don't think there's any doubt about it. I mean, if you look at where some of the most bizarre and awful sexual abuse goes on that produces so much human suffering, it's often in the U.S. in our trailer parks and in our poor rural areas that this takes place. And of course, we had studies here in the U.S. in the 70s that people don't like to repeat, showing that the most common denominator of being in a state mental hospital was not even in the days of racism, being African, heavy racism, being African American. It was just simple poverty. That was it. Poverty. Yep. And if you look at what correlates to the strongest with almost any mental distress, it's again going to be poverty. And
indeed.
So I think what you're saying is so important, that that we don't want, that it protects us from looking at the bad things. And yeah. No one's quite said that on this show in many, many years. And I think it's really good to have you on here, just putting it very directly like that. Psychiatry protects us from really looking squarely at and dealing with bad things, whether it's that in America, at least, I think everywhere to some extent, our schools are too large, too oppressive, too unimaginative, not even preparing people for modern economics. It's not like we still have assembly lines, so we want to prepare assembly line children to thrive nowadays. Yeah. You got to be an independent worker, and our schools don't take care of our kids, raise them properly and educate them and liberate them. And so we drug our children massively in the U.S. We're not doing well with our elders at all here. And we drug them hugely. We drug our foster children. Now we're drugging our military. There's a lot of feeling that we don't treat our military well in this country well enough. So, I mean, you've just got me going on a riff here or whatever, John.
Yeah, the drugging of children is particularly alarming, isn't it? And I'm afraid the USA does lead the way there, but Europe has followed very, very quickly. We're not far behind in the percentages of, especially our young boys, of course, who are effectively been put on amphetamines. You can call it Ritalin if you like, but that's what they are. And it's an awful thing to do to a child, just socially, the labeling of them as having this non-existent thing called ADHD, but then to mess up their developing brains with these very powerful chemicals is just criminal, absolutely criminal. In terms of what's behind ADHD, you might remember, Peter, in the 60s, that it was called, at that point, it was called minimal brain damage. That was actually the diagnosis for these kids. Same criteria, you know, not being able to sit still and that sort of thing, called minimal brain damage. Turned out to be so minimal they couldn't find it. So they did. That's when they changed the name to attention deficit disorder.
Yeah, and when they then invented the biochemical imbalance, which is the also doesn't exist follow-up of minimal brain damage.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with the brains of kids who can't sit still, and you've got to. I mean, it sounds cliche, but in some ways you should worry about the kids who do sit passively in those situations, those boring situations. But that's a bit of a
it's not a cliche really anymore. It's becoming a reality. I can't tell you. It breaks my heart to meet these parents who feel that their, quote, children are better behaved now, and what do I think of that? And it's only a cliche among a very small group of sophisticated people.
There aren't some kids that need some help. Some kids really are a handful for all sorts of reasons. Drugging them isn't the answer. Obviously, you show me a kid who's really, really struggling or out of control, and I'll show you some parents who need some help. Nine times out of ten. And our mental health system ought to be helping those parents learn how to set clear limits, non-punitive limits, but clear limits, and all of that basic parenting stuff that they might not have had themselves as kids. But we don't provide that help. Instead, we just tell them there's something biologically wrong with their kid and drug them. It's really not acceptable.
Yeah, and it's so rampant here. It's so out of control. Let me switch a little bit. We have some more time left, and what I think is just a stunning conversation. I'm so glad to have you
on
the
I'm
show.
Enjoying it.
Get it archived and have it available. Often when I'm sitting and working with somebody who has hallucinations and isn't certain that they're unreal, but is beginning to think about it that way, in the sense of that there isn't actually somebody in the office with me threatening them, not at least physically there. And who is struggling over, could all those terrible things really be making this happen? The people screaming and visual, in some cases, screaming and visually threatening in the office. How do you think of the processes whereby that person has come to experience this? I often tell folks it's just post-trauma. It's post-traumatic experience. This is what was done to you. This is what people said to you. It really became a part of you when you were 3 years old. I'm not sure that's always the best approach. What are your thoughts?
Well, of course, it's different for each person, as we were saying earlier, but that very often is the case. We have done a few studies, for what studies are worth, where when you look at people who have been diagnosed with schizophrenia who are hearing voices and who were traumatized as a child, the voice they are hearing about 50% of the time is just straightforwardly the voice of the person who abused them. Or didn't protect them, or whatever. So about half the time, there's a direct link, a very obvious and direct link. Other times, it's more a symbolic link. It might be people might experience God as having let them down and talking to them, or something not directly linked, but symbolic, not having protected them from the abuse. Voice hearers themselves talk a lot about, people in the voice hearing movement talk about how sometimes the voice is the voice of the child at that age, and it's a sort of split off part of themselves, a sort of dissociated part of themselves. The part got left behind at that point, or split off to protect that child. Other people hear voices of someone who tried to protect them. So it's different for
yes.
people. But the point is, almost always the voices have meaning. Which all cultures except Western culture understand. Like, so I was in New Zealand for 20 years, and Maori people in New Zealand have no problem understanding that people hear voices for very good reason. It's often a grandfather giving them advice or telling them off or whatever. Only in Western culture have we turned it into a bad thing and a meaningless, scary thing. And the way I try and explain it to people, if they're willing to listen, is that we all have dreams every night. Most of our dreams, or a lot of our dreams, are pretty weird. It's just that some people seem to have experiences like that when they're awake. And it shouldn't be quite as scary as Western society makes it out to be, because it doesn't need to be. It's always been there. There's always been a percentage of people who hear voices. Best estimates are between 10 and 20%. Of course, most people don't like to talk about it, though, because they're scared that they'll be thought of as mad and locked up. So it's not so abnormal. It's not always trauma-based. Some people just hear voices because people hear voices, and there's no particular reason for it at all. And as I said earlier, some people hear very good voices. Most hear a mixture. But all we ever hear about, of course, in our field is the really bad voices that tell people to kill themselves or kill other people. Which are quite rare, but do happen. The point I'm trying to make in a long-winded way, Peter, sorry.
No, you're doing great. Is that
voices are always meaningful. Just because I don't understand what they mean doesn't mean that they're not meaningful.
Yeah. I think
sadly, the only meaning they have for most psychiatrists is that it means that the person has something wrong with their brain and they're having experiences that they mustn't have and must be suppressed. Which is usually the opposite of what people need. They need some help figuring out what it means and what messages the voices are trying to tell them. Just as we kind of accept these days, don't we, that dreams have meaning and sometimes we can benefit from trying to figure them out. If we took the same approach to voices, I think we'd be a bit better off.
Yeah, I often sense that hearing voices is very much like a nightmare, and people experience it like a nightmare. It's just terrifying, often, not always, though. Two things I wanted to say in response to what you've just outlined. One is just especially for any of my clients or patients who might be listening. We've been talking a lot about schizophrenia here, and no, personally, I don't think any of you are schizophrenic. Not only do I not believe in the term, you don't fit the category either. The category is it's so meaningless and stupid, and you're human beings, and yeah. Don't think that I think in those terms. I don't. And it's interesting to me how I'll see people who might get labeled schizophrenic or have been by psychiatrists and all, and because they can't relate, but they relate to me. I mean, they can relate. Give them a chance. They can relate. So I just wanted to kind of erase that idea that I didn't want that sneaking into anyone's, particularly people I work with, thinking that I'm thinking in those terms or categories, or that they're like that. That caricature drawn so ugly by the psychiatry profession. The other thing is, one of the best things I think I ever wrote was in Toxic Psychiatry. I took vignettes that were put on a very big U.S. TV show by probably the most famous biological psychiatrist in the U.S., where they had all these patients on the air talking about the hallucinations and the whole thing was to prove that how stupid and meaningless they were. That was the point. He said, see, they have no meaning at all. Every single one of the five, I think it was about five patients, was describing child abuse. Mm-hmm. One guy had things blowing up in his head and his mouth. I mean, things like that. That was so obviously a relationship to abuse. So, it's there an awful lot that it's related directly to abuse.
It's not okay that there's a profession who, by and large, collude with people who deny the importance of child abuse. And we've got enough people doing that without having a so-called medical profession colluding with that. They ought to be on the front line identifying that and talking about how we need to put more services in to protect kids. And instead, they're giving governments a perfect excuse not to do anything about all of those things, not just child abuse, but inequality and so forth, and child neglect, which is an even bigger thing sort of numerically. So that's the function biological psychiatry serves for politicians. It means we don't have to do anything about these things because it's inevitable. We can't stop these biologically based illnesses. It's just part of the human condition, and we don't need to put more resources into making young children safe because it's got nothing to do with that. So that's the political function, and meanwhile you've just got thousands and thousands of individual people at the most vulnerable point in their lives receiving less than what they deserve and what they need, and that's the saddest thing of all, I think. But that, as I say, that's why it's so exciting that these people themselves have got fed up of waiting for us experts to sort it out and are getting on with it. And whatever support we can all give to the Hearing Voices Network, if only just publicizing it. It's early days in America, but there are quite a few groups over there. And I will certainly put you in touch with Jackie Dillon, and she will be able to put you in touch with people who are leading that movement in your country. Yeah. And perhaps you'll be able to help publicize that and get more people the support they need that way.
Absolutely. You know, it's worth mentioning, too, that the whole success of Freud's psychoanalytic movement involved the denial of child abuse, that early on Freud found that if he talked about child abuse, he would be utterly rejected by the men who dominated medicine. And although he never was a psychiatrist, people get confused about that because he was never a psychiatrist. He was never taught in a psychiatric facility. He was never invited to speak in a psychiatric facility. He developed really the roots of modern psychotherapy. But he committed a crime against humanity, as my friend Jeffrey Mason has written about so eloquently.
Indeed.
When he decided it was in his interest to make believe that patients had Oedipal complexes and yearned for their parents rather than their parents and other people in the family were abusing them. So again, we have this huge betrayal based on what you so well put as, you know, covering up and denying bad things. And it's one of the reasons why for a while psychoanalysis, you know, had some embedding in psychiatry. I think 10% at the maximum in the U.S. of psychiatrists ever were analysts, but it was because of that denial. Because psychiatrists in this country who wanted to bring up child abuse as a cause of human suffering, of the suffering of their patients, they got the hammer. So
indeed.
This is
Jeffrey's a friend of mine too, because he was in New Zealand, of course, when I was
was
there. So we've spent many a long hour chewing over all of this, and I think his book Assault on Truth is probably one of the most important books of the 20th century. But that's another story, really.
It's the same story, isn't it?
The story of collusion to deny the extent of child abuse and the importance of it, and it's just so sad and so embarrassing that mental health professionals, from Freud through to biological psychiatry, have played such an opposite role to the role that they ought to be playing.
Yeah. It was really the feminists in the U.S. and I think certainly the victims, some of the early books written in Great Britain, it was the women who came forward and the feminists who came forward and said child abuse is rampant. Some of them sociologists, some of them victims. It was not the mental health profession, as far as I understand at all.
No, we didn't lead the way.
What about your work? We have some time left to talk about where you're going.
Not everybody who ends up hearing voices has been abused, and not everyone who is abused ends up hearing voices. And
yes.
So it's just important to add that, because sometimes I get accused of saying that, and I'm certainly not saying that, and I know you don't think that either. It's just a factor that we need to pay more attention to,
because
there's so many people who do need some help with that, that's all.
No, and also I think very few people who are abused become abusers. I see people all the time who, as tiny children, 2, 3, 4, 5 years old, as early as they can remember being abused, and that they would never behave that way toward anybody, ever. And then their major problem becomes self-assertion, because they've imposed this blanket, I will never hurt anybody, inhibition on themselves. But some people who are abused do become abusers. Let me take a minute
tend to happen to women. That's an interesting thing. We're not sure we understand quite what that's about. Tends to be more, not all men, of course, I quickly add. Not all men who are abused go on to be abusers. Many, many people, we should acknowledge this, I think you touched on it earlier, Peter, many people who have had bad things happen to them in childhood go on to be mental health professionals one way or another, social workers or nurses or psychologists or whatever, in an attempt to try and help other people who have been through similar things. So that's an interesting phenomenon in its own right.
Absolutely. I want to say a word about this psychiatry covering up things, the badness, because one of the things that's going on in our country and is going to happen more and more in Europe, I think, is that there'll be this call for more psychiatric screening, more psychiatry to deal with the various kinds of mass murders we're dealing with. There are headlines going on right now in Europe that some of the very recent, this is talking about very recent, being in around toward the end of July, that some of these people have mental health issues as well as having ideological issues. And of course, there are different kinds of mass murders, and some are more ideologically driven. And in the U.S., we've had some who have their only ideology is their personal vengeance and hatred and, you know, getting even for what they feel has happened to them. But again, psychiatry plays a cover-up role because most of the people in this country who you'd say would be, say, personally motivated or personal ideologies have been through the psychiatric web, and many of them are on psychiatric drugs at the time or shortly before their violence, and nearly all of them have been through psychiatry. And I think that the psychiatric process has just humiliated them more. It hasn't helped them at all. And I have a blog up now on Mad in America where I look at several of the key shooters. I was a medical expert in a couple of the several high-profile cases, and I've written some about that, new information. So I have a blog on Mad in America about mass murder, and it's called, I believe, Antidepressant Induced Violence, an update. Again, the psychiatry doesn't do the job. It can't do social control. It doesn't have any tools of work. All it's got is a hammer to hit everybody on the head with. And it makes a lot of people much more violent, much more angry, much more frustrated, humiliated, and dangerous.